course, have been looking at the cases following Griswold and Roe that revise the right to terminate a pregnancy. And we're going to circle back and get back to that subject again, at least in part, although we've now examined all of these cases. But I think that the best way to do that is actually to go forward and to look at cases outside of the abortion area in which the court also recognizes, well, is asked to recognize the existence of a fundamental right to privacy. Which results in some cases in which the court does recognize such a right and some cases in which it doesn't. And the first three of these cases, Loving versus Virginia, Zablocki versus Redhale, and Turner versus Safley, all involve the right to marry. And what's the court's conclusion about the right to marry? Is it a fundamental right, as the court sees it in these cases? Maureen, you're nodding your head.
I am nodding my head. I'm trying to find my notes where I found that's just that. But yeah.
Okay.
But I'll find it.
I have the freedom to marry has long been recognized as one of the vital personal rights essential to the order. The order may pursue of happiness by freedmen.
Okay.
Yes.
So is that similar to the rationale in Griswold? What kind of reason is the court giving for the decision that the right to marry is a fundamental right? Remember back in Griswold, if you had to just summarize why the right of the married couple to use contraceptives was considered to be fundamental, what's the gist of it in terms of the court's decision?
Okay. Oh, I see they've cleaned out all the markers.
Oh, it's Casey Perry.
She says Katy Perry.
Okay, let's try these. See what I got.
Okay, so in Griswold, the court explains that they reach the decision they do based on history and tradition, among other things, perhaps. What about with the right to marry? Is this another history and tradition decision, or are there other explanations for the decision that the court reaches that this is a fundamental right? What do you think?
Don't they say something that it was like the basic civil rights of the human being as the right to choose who, if you want to marry?
How do you decide if something is a basic right of a human being? I mean, what would we consult? I take it there's no kind of big book of basic rights.
Is it, they say something like it's essential in the pursuit of happiness.
Essential in the pursuit of happiness,
but
yep.
It's fundamental to our existence and survival.
Fundamental to our existence and survival.
Couldn't imagine the system being fair without it.
Okay, couldn't imagine a kind of a what, a democratic or a liberal society without it? So how do we summarize all of that? Is there some
deeply rooted history?
Well, that's the same thing as Griswold, right? Have we added anything? Is there an alternative to the Griswold approach, which is really the question that I'm getting at? What if we look back to the abortion cases? Where the court somewhat redefines why the right is fundamental if you move from Roe through to Casey. But do we learn anything about why the court reached that decision? After all, that case was not rooted in history and tradition in its decision to recognize the right as fundamental. So there must be an alternative to the history and tradition approach that hopefully is broad enough to encompass the right to marry cases.
I could be wrong, it's kind of vague, but they were talking mainly about the procreation, and since they see the marriage as the proper way to do it, so it's the basis of, you know,
Well, okay, but Griswold is not rooted in that, right? Because it's a right of a woman married or single, right? The court has left behind the notion that this attaches to the specific relationship of the couple, because the woman has this right in Griswold no matter what her marital status. So do we have some other, what if we go back to the court's discussion, find where that is, if we go back to the court's discussion in Casey, where the court talks about why the right is fundamental. In the middle of the first page, starting with the line, our law affords constitutional protection to personal decisions relating to marriage, procreation, contraception, etc. Why don't you read that couple of sentences to see whether we can craft a kind of summary of what the court's talking about there.
I wasn't looking exactly where you were, but there is a lot of O'Connor's describing how the concept of our existence and liberty, how it's attached to that, and that
okay.
could be connected to loving in the sense of making decisions about marrying.
Well, what about we're in that language that I was talking about in the second sentence, these matters involving the most intimate and personal choices a person may make in a lifetime. Does that help us with the marriage cases? Let's try that. Is that another way to create a kind of a limited class of additional fundamental rights to focus on those choices, intimate and personal choices. So this is about choice, but not every kind of choice. Not, you know, whether you're going to order the hamburger or the tuna melt, but choices that are intimate and personal. And even, of course, as the most intimate and personal. Anything else that it says in that paragraph that we can add to this? Dignity and autonomy, is that different than? They follow along the ability to make personal choices free from government intrusion. That's really the autonomy we have, the autonomy to make these choices free of government intrusion into our into the personal choices that we make. At another point, kind of later on in that same paragraph, the court talks about the fact that these are beliefs about these matters could not define the attributes of personhood were they formed under compulsion of the state. So the court thinks that we're talking about things that are central to personal identity. Intimate personal choices central to personal identity. That's going to give the court what kind of category? I mean, is it a big category of rights, a limited category of rights, too narrow, too big, or in the Goldilocks model, just right?
It seems just right because it does encompass those things that do feel, that generally feel too intimate and personal, like who to marry, whether to have children, but it doesn't include like the right to have a tuna fish sandwich or something like that, because that wouldn't be central to a personal.
At least not for most of us.
I think it's something though that can expand itself like unwarrantedly. I mean, it leaves a lot of room for, you know, central to your personal identity and the right to privacy. It just seems like that one day there's a possibility that they can get, you know, a little maybe futile, you know, people want to start marrying animals or, I don't know, something silly, but, you know, it just seems like it leaves so too much room.
Okay, so this one is not limited in quite the same fashion. What about this? Can this grow? Can it grow at all, or is it kind of locked into a particular sort of historical moment?
It can grow, but it's going to be longer. I mean, for it to be history, it can't be just...
Yeah, and I take it the court's not just talking about recent history. I mean, they are looking back to ancient roots. And so this might be able to grow modestly if we look forward 100 years, maybe, but there's not much room for expansion here. And that's particularly true if the court looks at our history and tradition dating back to when?
The Revolution, or the signing of the Constitution.
Yes, dating back to when the Constitution first was ratified, or in a kind of a version of this, dating back to the ratification of the 14th Amendment. So either back in 1798 or move forward a little bit till we're talking about the mid-1800s. But those are really the defining times in terms of history and tradition dating back to the adoption of the Constitution, either in general or the specific provision, the 14th Amendment that we're interpreting. So this one could grow, this one not so much. And not surprisingly, as we'll see, the justices who are most interested in history and tradition tend to be originalists who want to narrow the reach of these rights, and the justices who are most interested in number two tend to adopt a different model of the Constitution as a document that can grow over time and get reinterpreted in every age. Okay, so so if we look at the right to marry, would it be a fundamental right under both of these? Only one, not the other?
I'm sorry. The right to marry could be, but the right to for interracial marriage probably more the second.
More the second, because history and tradition would not necessarily support protection for interracial marriages.
I definitely agree with Maureen, but I think even more, marriage, at least to different sexes, based in history and tradition, because its purpose was procreation, and, you know, but so same-sex marriage is definitely
so. So,
sort of including interracial
marriage. So how much of a right to marry we might protect might depend on whether we are operating only with number one or whether we're operating under number two. Okay. So there is this right to marry. The court talks about it, but of course it only talks about it in the context of these few cases that don't really push the boundaries except when it comes to interracial marriage, of what the meaning of marriage is. What would the court do if a lawsuit was brought asserting the right to marry brought by a polygamist who lived in a household where a man had three wives and each of the three wives had three children, so we have a family of 13. I guess it works out too, and they argued that they had some kind of fundamental right to marry the man and his three wives.
In the history and tradition, because that's not a tradition of most people in the United States.
Okay, so it's not something that we have long, that's part of the fabric of our society, doesn't have, it has ancient roots, but not supported by the majority of people in the United States, since it's a practice that's been illegal in most states for a long time. And I think is what?
So that's why they ended up in Utah. They are chasing everywhere else.
Of course, it's even been illegal in Utah for a long time, because when Utah became a state, the federal government required that as a condition of statehood that Utah outlaw polygamy. And so even in Utah, there's there's a long history of plural marriage being illegal, in part because of this condition of statehood. And if you look around the country and you look at states that entered the Union past the colonial period, you'll see that the federal government often imposed various kinds of conditions on states that wanted to join the Union. The Utah example is just one of those. So what about, I mean, history and tradition doesn't help. Well, what about the second theory? If we recognize the second theory, do we also have to recognize that there's a fundamental right to engage in polygamy? Is that the cost of a more expansive theory, or is there some way around that?
We can't say that they used up their one go of marriage, can we? No, I think you're right. I think we're stuck with it. I mean, or to a certain degree, I mean, it would be very, based on those definitions, it would be very hard to argue against someone's right to polygamy, I think.
Okay, well, we'll come back to this question, but that's, of course, some of the things the court has to struggle with as they move through this line of cases. So in these three marriage cases, what is the consequence of considering the right to be fundamental? What kind of analysis does the court engage in here? Do they use strict scrutiny? Do they use some other test? Do we know? I mean, traditionally in our cases, once you decide the right is fundamental, this is what Griswold tells us, then normally you would apply the strict scrutiny standard. We saw that modified, compromised somewhat in Roe. What about in these cases? What standard does the court appear to be applying? Does it say, do we have some inkling of what the court is doing here?
I'll take a guess. I feel like it was strict scrutiny because the government failed in almost all of them to show, and they failed usually under the 14th Amendment's due process clause.
Okay, so they failed to adequately justify the law in Loving. That's true in Zablocki as well. That's also true in Turner versus Safley. They're all struck down. Which suggests at least some more rigorous standard than minimum rationality. But do we see the telltale signs of strict scrutiny, which are usually some discussion of compelling governmental interests anywhere? They didn't, that's right.
But they
were very cagey, and they used different kinds of terminology. At one point they talk about sufficiently important state interests or substantial state interests. When does the court use that terminology? What's that associated with? Have we seen the court talk about substantial state interests as compared to legitimate state interests or compelling state interests? Not in the Commerce Clause as such, but what about the Privileges and Immunities Clause? If we look back to the test, we would find a similar kind of statement about the standard of review. Do you remember how that standard was described? Not strict, not minimum, but intermediate scrutiny, absolutely. The court describes, the case book describes, and that's, it is correct, that was an example of the adoption of intermediate scrutiny as a choice. Now, the fact that the court uses the term sufficiently important state interest doesn't necessarily mean that they're adopting that. There's a tendency in these cases when the court isn't quite sure which way to go to use language that's fairly broad, and could encompass both intermediate and strict scrutiny, and to refer to what they're doing as rigorous review, which is a terminology broad enough to cover the two forms of enhanced review we have, which is intermediate and strict. And so they're both still on the table. But if you look at why the court strikes down the rule in Zablocki, for example, if we think through the Zablocki example, Zablocki is the deadbeat dad who's failed to pay his child support, and the law in Wisconsin prohibits him from getting a marriage license under that circumstance. Does the state have an important governmental interest in making sure that minor children are supported by their parents? Sure. And probably we would consider that to be a compelling interest, not only an important interest, that minor children be supported. Why is this unconstitutional, this particular technique for enforcing achieving that state interest?
Well, they were talking about more alternative, less intrusive means, such as garnishing wages or something to that extent.
Yes, less intrusive means. And whenever we see the court talk about less intrusive means, what standard of review does that sound like? Less intrusive means. Well, it's partly discussed just to compare the narrowness of available means, but less intrusive means is a signal of strict scrutiny, where the government has to choose the least restrictive alternative of those available, and the law could be unconstitutional because it fails to make that selection. So there's some suggestion here of strict scrutiny, some suggestion of intermediate scrutiny, and the court really never comes out and says. And Justice Powell is very worried about the choice of standard of review, which he describes his concern in his concurring opinion. So what's he worried about?
Worried if there's a less stringent scrutiny than other types of.
Is he worried if there's less stringent scrutiny?
Well, he indicates that he talks about how he's afraid about like bans on incest and bigamy and so forth.
Right, and when would they be struck down?
If there was greater scrutiny.
Greater scrutiny, that's right. He's worried about strict scrutiny. His concern is that the higher the standard of review, the more state regulations will fall. And what kind of regulations are there of the marital relationship? That the state has. What we've talked about limiting who can marry. What else? What else does the state do by way of a regulation of the marital relationship?
Age.
Blood tests. What else? Anything else?
Is it different with felons?
No.
I don't think so.
I was just guessing.
Right.
Licenses and fees don't count, do
they? Well, are they restrictions?
No.
Are they regulations of the right to marry?
Yes.
Oh. They are regulations. You can't get married unless you have a marriage license. You can't get married unless you pay a fee for the marriage license. You can't get married unless you have a blood test. Some states have waiting periods. There has to be a period of time between applying for the marriage license and the issuance of the marriage license, so people don't make hasty decisions. I don't think that applies in Las Vegas. In general, there are states that have waiting periods. So what's Justice Powell worried about? Could those survive strict scrutiny? Could waiting periods, marriage licenses, blood tests, all of those kinds of regulations of the marital relationship, could they survive strict scrutiny? Are they the least restrictive alternative means available? If you're worried that people may have certain communicable diseases, sexually transmitted diseases, for instance, and you order, therefore, you tell people you can't marry unless you have a blood test, what's less restrictive than that? What would you say, what could the state do short of requiring a blood test? Well, that would be less restrictive. Or if the state's worried that that people might not know about these risks, they could inform them. It's a good idea to have this kind of test before you enter into marriage, but not require it. They could explain why it's a good idea, what kind of things it might reveal, what they might want to know. What about a waiting period? We have a 48-hour waiting period because we don't want people to marry in haste.
Similar idea, you can inform them of whatever statistical or things to think about before you begin.
Or we could shorten the time period. It doesn't have to be 48 hours. Why not 12 hours? I mean, that still gives people some time. It's not the least restrictive alternative. So one of the things that Justice Powell is worried about is that so many of the state's restrictions on marriage might fall under this test.
Informing the public,
that's not a compelling
government interest, is it? Informing the public. Like you were just saying, like, to avoid hasty marriages, there's a 48-hour period where maybe people can think, and you were saying that a less restrictive way would just tell them?
Yes. Public education. Tell people, marriage is a serious business. We're going to give you this piece of paper to sign saying that you understand that once you're married, then you have legal obligations that can't be easily set aside, and that the state recommends that you give some thought to this. Something short of an absolute ban on this kind of decision. It's always going to be less restrictive. And in a lot of the court's cases, a less restrictive alternative is often something that is... that's maybe not even really a regulation, but there's actually been some arguments among the justices about whether if the alternative is purely educational in quality, does that make it an alternative, or does the alternative have to be regulatory in character? And there's a dispute among the justices about that question, so maybe those wouldn't be, but certainly the waiting period could be shorter, it would still be a waiting period, for example.
I guess that's what I was kind of trying to say, is that there wouldn't be regulatory anymore, it's just all...
Well, but it's still an alternative means of accomplishing the state's interest, and for some members of the court, that would be enough. I mean, this comes up, I'll give you an example of this. When it comes to regulation of the content of broadcast television, the FCC has some indecency regulations, and... an argument is that instead of actually prohibiting this kind of programming, that you can give parents tools to use. Let's say we're talking about cable television. An alternative would be parental lock provisions as part of the cable television setup, so parents who wanted to could control what their children have access to. And some of the justices say, well, that's not really regulatory. That just gives people a tool that's less restrictive, but not regulatory because it doesn't force any behavior on any group of people. And there's a disagreement among the justices about whether that should be viewed as a less restrictive alternative, although there are quite a few cases where the less restrictive alternative discussed isn't regulatory. So, it's not clear about the answer to that question.
The blood tests are those still, I know there's some states that they don't require them.
Well, this is of course state by state. They can, states can require or not require. Presumably there are some states that still require some kind of blood test.
But
I mean, it was a traditional.
Require it and they
what?
Stopped. So I was just wondering if maybe they had some cases.
Oh, no, I don't think that there are any cases that have outlawed this kind of requirement. And why do you think that is? How come, even though they may seem like constitutionally suspect, why do you think that that some of these have not been successfully challenged? Is there a difference between a regulation that says you may not marry, no ban on same-sex marriage, for example, and a regulation that says You can only get a marriage license after you wait 24 hours and only after you have a blood test. If you compare those two, are they different in some way that we ought to care about?
One's
an outright, an outright ban, and the other?
It just kind of puts conditions on how you go about doing it. You can still get married.
You can still get married. Okay. And in this particular case, you notice that Justice Marshall in Zablocki starts out at the beginning of his opinion. It's not quite the beginning, but the first part we have, right at the beginning of this edited version, states that since the right to marry is of fundamental importance, and since the classification at issue here significantly interferes with the exercise of that right, we believe that critical examination of the state interest advanced is required. Critical examination is like rigorous review, something more than minimum rationality. So he thinks that this law amounts to a significant interference with the exercise of the right as compared to how he might view some waiting period or blood test requirement. Do we have any mechanism for dealing with regulations that are like some of the marriage regulations, where some regulations are an absolute ban and others are more minor intrusions? Have we seen any mechanism that the courts use in that kind of situation to sort out the different kinds of regulations that exist? I mean, this didn't come up in Griswold because Griswold was an absolute ban. Has it come up in any of our cases?
There was, I'm forgetting the name of the, where it was, I think, in the New Hampshire law, we just did it last night, I'm sorry, where it was struck down, the court said, you don't have to get rid of the whole darn law, but you could sever certain elements of it. Is that what you're
That's not what I'm really talking about. I'm talking about the fact that it turns out that not all that fundamental rights, when they are regulated, are not all regulated to the same extent. Sometimes the exercise of the right is outright banned, a prohibition on contraception, for instance, on abortion. And other times there are circumstances where the intrusion in the exercise of the right is well short of an absolute ban, but simply makes the exercise of the right slightly more time-consuming or difficult. Have we seen that?
The undue burden.
The undue burden test. That's exactly right. The undue burden test separates, as it turns out, one category of abortion regulations from another based on how significantly the regulation interferes with the exercise of the right. Read again Justice Marshall's opening comment that the right to marry is fundamental importance, and since the classification at issue here significantly interferes with the exercise of that right, we believe that critical examination of the state interest advanced is required. What would he say here if he was looking at a 24-hour waiting period? What would the alternative to this case be if he didn't find, would he find that to be a significant interference with the exercise of the right?
No.
No, so it wouldn't be significant. So what would he conclude about how to scrutinize a minor intrusion on the exercise of the right to marry? Maybe if it was just rationally related. So in that sense, he would be using essentially the equivalent of the undue burden test, whether it's a substantial obstacle or not. For what purpose? What function is it now going to serve in the marriage cases if he employs it? If it is an undue burden, then what test is he going to apply? Strict scrutiny or something just about like that. If it's not an undue burden, what test is he going to apply?
Rational basis.
And so under that theory, what's going to happen to waiting periods and blood tests and other kinds of, you know, administrative requirements that don't prohibit marriage. They're going to be okay because they're going to survive minimum rationality review. And nobody's going to be able to say, oh, why is it 48 hours? Why not 24 hours? Because it doesn't have to be the least restrictive alternative. Could the undue burden test be performing the same function in the abortion cases? We've seen this kind of thing before in a lot of our cases where there's some preliminary determination that functions as a way of sorting cases into one of two tracks. And depending on the track, you get a stricter or a less strict standard of review. Where have we seen that? In the Commerce Clause, the Dormant Commerce Clause, right? If it's discrimination against interstate commerce, we use the strict test. If it's just a burden on interstate commerce, we use the balancing test. So we don't treat them all the same. We use that initial inquiry as a way of sorting the cases into ones that, depending on, into two categories which involve a different level of scrutiny. Is that happening here? If a law is not an undue burden, is it automatically constitutional under the abortion cases? Or is there some scrutiny that we still employ to look at that law once we have decided that it doesn't impose an undue burden? Let's take a look at the court's discussion in the most recent of our, in Gonzalez versus Carhart. Go to the bottom of 460. To the top of to the top of actually the top of 461. The sentence that begins, where it has a rational basis to act and it does not impose an undue burden, the state may use its regulatory power to bar certain procedures and substitute others, all in furtherance of its legitimate interests in regulating the medical profession in order to promote respect for life, including life of the unborn. What does that mean? What's the consequence of a law being viewed as not imposing an undue burden? What other tests does it have to satisfy? If it's not an undue burden, is that what that language says? Rational basis. Isn't that what it says? It says where a law, where it has a rational basis to act, and it does not impose an undue burden. So switch it around. Where it does not impose an undue burden, it still needs to have a rational basis, and it still needs to further a legitimate interest. So not every single example of laws that are not an undue burden on the exercise of the right to terminate a pregnancy will be constitutional, only those that satisfy the minimum rationality test so that there is the means are rationally related to a legitimate end. That still has to be true, even though the law does not impose an undue burden. What happens if the law imposes an undue burden? Is it automatically unconstitutional? Or could it survive scrutiny nevertheless, even if it is unduly burdensome? Are there abortion regulations that we've seen the court uphold, essentially, even though they impose an undue burden? What's the only real example we have of that?
The partial birth?
Not the partial birth so much. I mean, although because the court decides that's not an undue burden, right? So they simply get rid of that problem by saying it's not an undue burden.
The 24-hour?
The 24-hour is not an undue burden. I'm asking whether we've seen laws that clearly impose an undue burden, but it would nevertheless be upheld. What would be upheld, even though it imposes an undue burden, indeed an absolute barrier to abortion?
After viability.
That's right. Some laws, as it turns out, are going to be constitutional, even if they impose an undue burden. And those, we have one example, is a law that bans abortion after viability. And that suggests, therefore, that it's not, the undue burden test doesn't really operate on its own. It operates as a kind of a threshold inquiry that sorts the abortion cases into two lines of decision, one where we're applying strict scrutiny, and the other where the court's applying minimum rationality review. Not an undue burden, it only has to be minimally rational. It is an undue burden, it has to survive strict scrutiny. That's another way, that's a third way that we've come up with to look at the undue burden test. What the real question here is, what role does it play? And where else can it be used? Where else might the court use it? And that's why we've talked about the marriage cases, the possibility of using it to sort through and treat differently the modest restrictions on the right to marry, like 24-hour waiting periods, as compared to the ones that absolutely bar marriage. What if the state had a requirement of some kind of premarital counseling? You had to see a therapist for two sessions before you could marry. So they could be sure that people understood what marriage meant and what kind of compromises might be necessary, etc., that they were really ready for this relationship. How would the court analyze that?
Well, I mean, I think it's not an automatic bar, but they would have to look at the undue, I mean, they would have to, when they use the undue burden test.
Well, if they did, what do you think? Would they use that test to sort, to decide how to treat that kind of restriction?
I think they could, but I mean, they would really have to find where the burden lies. I mean, they would have to look at, you know, if it was really expensive to get 2 days of counseling. And
okay, what if the state provided the counseling at no charge? So we get rid of the financial burden. Now it's just time. Well, what if the state ordered counseling is really on the question of, do you have the financial resources to marry? Do you have an effective way of resolving disputes between the husband and wife? Have you faced the fact that there may be decisions about whether to have a child or not, how to raise that child? I mean, have you thought about the various issues? In other words, not religion, but things that are that have to do with the marital relationship in a more general sense.
I think part of it is at the end of the counseling, what role does the counselor have in getting your name?
The counselor has no role in prohibiting marriage. There's no bar. You sign up for the two sessions. The counselor says they were here for the two sessions. You get your marriage license. Undue burden? How would you compare this to the abortion cases?
So persuasive versus?
Well, it's not even really persuasive in the sense.
Informative.
It's informative. Well, under the undue burden test, as we've seen it in the abortion cases, providing information is fine, is not an undue burden. And so if that's the test, the only question is whether it's rationally related to a legitimate purpose. Well, the legitimate purpose is trying to make sure that people only marry after they've had time to think about it so that the marriage is likely to endure. And the means are related to the end because it's designed to kind of get people to think about some of the questions that may arise, and it may therefore avoid some early hasty marriages. So under minimum rationality, it's okay. Under strict scrutiny, maybe not okay. But if we use the undue burden, we can sort it into the minimum rationality standard, and the state can easily uphold it. So this using the undue burden test as this kind of threshold inquiry does allow you to treat differently the absolute prohibitions on abortion, on marriage or abortion or contraception, because they're automatically undue burdens, because they bar the exercise of the right completely. So in those cases, there's no issue. You kind of immediately go to the strict test. This only protects the state from in its ability to impose more modest restrictions if it's the kind of right where that makes sense. Not every fundamental right may be able to be split like this. There may not be modest restrictions. I mean, what would they do in Griswold? You can buy contraceptives on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, but not on Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday. I mean, there's no either. It's a kind of either or proposition. So a lot of the time, the laws are really our barriers, our prohibitions. In which case, we don't really have an undue burden issue that we even have to look at. But particularly in cases where we're talking about restraints that are short of an absolute barrier, short of a ban, this test might be used. And in the marriage cases, there are signs that the court is inclined to use it, although there haven't been any recent cases, and so we don't know this for sure, but there are at least some signs. Okay, other than marriage, what other kinds of fundamental rights are there? What else is added to the list? What about the right to divorce? You've gotten married, but now you're not very happy. And the state makes it very hard to get a divorce. What about that? Could someone say they have a fundamental right to terminate their marriage? What do you think?
Yes.
It's another intimate personal choice,
so if there's a right to marry, there should be a right to divorce on the same kind of theory, even though that one doesn't have the same history and tradition because it has in the past been much more difficult to get divorced than it is now in most places. What else? What else would be on this list? Children, the right to have children, the right to make choices to protect the well-being of your child, the kind of parental relationship questions about where your child goes to school, what religion they're raised in, if any, and other kinds of choices about medical care for your child. Now, none of these are necessarily absolutes, and obviously if a parent is abusing the child, the state can intervene. So it's not that the state has no role to play, but it's a fundamental right, so the state's role is going to be modest because it can only, the relationship is only going to get interfered with in these kind of extreme cases where the state can justify its intervention. So the right to raise a child, this came up in the early cases where the state barred having people learn foreign languages. They couldn't teach German in the schools, and it was challenged, and the theory was that a parent has a right to decide that in raising their child that learning another language is something their child should learn, and the state's ability to interfere with that kind of parental decision is modified. in the recent cases, there's one parental rights case, or the relatively recent cases. In 2000, the court decided Troxell versus Granville on the bottom of 467, a case involving a conflict between the parent of a child and the grandparent of a child. And the parent was refusing to allow grandparent visitation, and the grandparents went to court to try and get the judge to order the parents to allow them to have an ongoing relationship with their grandchild. And the parent won, which is to say the grandparents lost. So why do the grandparents lose? Don't they have some right at issue?
Well, but it doesn't override, the state cannot make child-rearing decisions for the parents.
So in that case, the parents have a fundamental right to this kind of decisional autonomy in the choices that they make for the well-being of their child. And if the parents have that kind of right, then can the grandparents also have that kind of right? Or is this an either or? Could you recognize the grandparents as having this kind of a fundamental right at the same time as you recognize the parents having a fundamental right?
Well, wouldn't it run into the parents would have a fundamental right just because they're parents? However, they have to be a fit parent, and if they're not, the grandparents can be?
Well, that's a little different because now we're talking about the state's ability to terminate parental rights in extreme circumstances. And the court has talked about this issue many times and has imposed many restraints on the state's ability to declare a parent to be unfit. The parent has lots of procedural due process rights that attach. The state has to prove unfitness to a higher level of proof than would ordinarily be true in civil cases.
Well, if the parent, you know, the traditional family, mother and father, they have a fundamental right to care for their kids as they see fit, as long as they're a fit parent. So giving that right to someone else over those kids is just taking away from them.
You can't have it both ways. Either the parents get to control that decision or they don't. It's not possible for both the parent and the grandparents to simultaneously have that right.
Not only that, parents have a certain duty towards children versus grandparents don't have that same duty. You're giving them the right.
But not a duty.
You're not giving them a duty.
But the court in this case, you know, clearly comes down. At the time of this case, there was a lot of thought that maybe grandparents should have some constitutionally protected right to an ongoing relationship with their grandchild. But the court said, as between, in this kind of circumstance where there's a tension between the rights of the grandparents and the right of the parents, it's the parental rights that have primacy. And the parents get to make the choice that their child shouldn't have contact with their grandparents, even, says the court, even if we think that a better decision could be made. It's not about what the court thinks, it's about autonomy in decision making to the parents in making decisions about the raising of their child. Sure, there are cases where a child is independently a party to litigation where their interests are at stake. If there's a divorce, for example, the court's trying to make a custody decision, then a guardian ad litem could be appointed for the child, and there could be a social worker who investigates which is the best household in which the child should be raised, because there's no choice. I mean, there's two parents with equal legal rights, and the court has to make some decision, and the child's interests get independently represented. But in this kind of context, in general, a child really cannot trump the interests of their of the parent. Just think about what this would mean if children didn't like how they were being raised, and they could go to court and object I wanted to go and visit, spend overnight with a friend of mine, and my parents said, no, please independently investigate whether I should have been allowed to do that,
no,
or my curfew.
I mean something more substantial, like if there's a child that had an ongoing relationship his whole life, with the grandparent, so now this child lost a parent and subsequently loses a grandparent, all because the sole surviving parent is selfish.
That was basically Troxell. That's basically this case. And a court says, you know, it's a sad matter, but ultimately the right to raise their child and make decisions, bad or good, for the well-being of their child rests with the parents, as against the grandparents. Sometimes in certain extreme circumstances, children can seek to be emancipated minors in order to be able to control the decisions for themselves, but that's obviously the extreme case, and not with very young children. That wouldn't be possible. That might be possible in the case of teenagers, etc. But that's really what this case was all about, whether that parent gets to say, I always hated his parents, and now I don't have to deal with them anymore. And this court says, that's right.
I mean, that's mental abuse on the child.
Well.
I'll be the guardian ad litem.
I think I see a career path in front of you. Okay, so interestingly, we have one other grandparent case, but in a slightly different circumstance and with a different outcome, and that's Moore versus City of East Cleveland back in 1977. Mrs. Moore is the grandmother to two grandsons, and her grandsons are the offspring of two of her children. So let's say she had two children, each child had a child, so she has two grandsons who are first cousins to each other as opposed to brothers. And she lives in East Cleveland, and East Cleveland has a very restrictive zoning ordinance that for the definition of single family household. Most residential zoning ordinances have some kind of definition that limits occupancy to single families, or many of them do, most. And in order to do that, they have to define in some fashion what's a single family. And in East Cleveland, for various reasons, they decided that this particular relationship, the grandmother and her two grandsons, did not fall within the definition of single family. If she'd been raising a single grandson, she would have qualified. If she'd been raising two grandsons who were brothers, she would have qualified, but she didn't qualify because of the fact that two grandsons were first cousins and not brothers. So she brings this case to the United States Supreme Court, and what does she argue? What's she going to have to argue first? What's the first thing she wants to establish in order to win? That she has a fundamental right to have to live with her two grandsons, right? Because if it's not a fundamental right, it's going to just get rational basis review, and it's going to survive that level of scrutiny, even if it's mostly a ridiculous restriction. It's still not going to matter as long as the state's going to be able to say something in favor of it. It's going to reduce overcrowding, whatever they argue. And what's she going to rely on to make that argument that she has a right to live with her, as a family, with her two grandsons? What's she going to rely on?
Both.
Both. Okay. So she's going to argue this is a kind of personal choice central to identity. What the family? Who's going to raise these children or grandsons? Because one or both of their parents are unavailable for various reasons. Her daughter had died. Her son was in jail for part of the time period at issue here. And so she's going to make a number two argument. Can she make a number one argument? And what does the Supreme Court say about this? I mean, the argument on the other side, the argument that that East Cleveland makes is, we only have a tradition of family, of nuclear families, mom, dad, and the kids. You know, like Ozzie and Harriet, or Father Knows Best, or you know, the traditional television family in sort of in the 50s and 60s. Mom, dad, and the kids.
Well, Powell was talking about how the traditional values have passed down the lines of family, and it doesn't have to be a nuclear family. It can come from grandparents.
Okay. And what if it were, you know, an uncle and aunt raising their niece and nephew? Would it?
I think as long as they're related in some way, because that's how they overturned the other case.
Okay, so some kind of relationship, and the court says here, the tradition of uncles, aunts, cousins, and especially grandparents sharing a household along with parents and children has roots equally venerable and equally deserving of constitutional protection. Roots. That's, of course, the Griswold terminology, deep roots. And so this relationship, the court says, is supported by history and tradition, and it's also one of those personal choices that fall within the zone of privacy. Any other way to analyze this kind of case? We have these two approaches. Is there a third approach? What's the first thing you would do if you had a case like this, a potential right of privacy case? What would you do? Well, okay, I mean, you would eventually look at the state's interests, but in order to decide what kind of interest they need, what would you first have to know? I mean, do they need a compelling interest or only a legitimate interest? What's the first question you always have to answer in figuring out what test is going to be applied? In order to figure out what test is going to be applied, you have to know whether it's a fundamental right or not. Because if it's not a fundamental right, it's going to get very cursory review, and if it is, then it's of course going to get very stringent review and it likely will be struck down. And what these are is ways of analyzing the question of whether it is or is not a fundamental right. But in general, outside of this area, you get a case, a client comes to you and says, oh, the state has done this terrible thing to me. What do you normally do? What do you normally do as a lawyer? What's the first thing you look for before you can assess the likelihood that you're going to win your case? What do you always look at?
What are the rights violated?
Well, okay, but what rights? What kind of rights?
Oh, we're promising whether it's fundamental.
Okay, and how do we, what's the easiest way to figure out, or at least the starting point for figuring out whether it's fundamental or not? Well, that, you're still, you know what? The problem with what you're doing is you're thinking that every question is the first time it's ever come up.
Oh, precedent.
Precedent!
That's right. You really want us to actually think like lawyers.
Right. So the first question is going to be, well, is this like other cases? Because what if you got a grandparent case? I mean, you're going to spend all your time spinning your wheels, and then you're going to realize, oh, my God, Troxel was already decided. And that's going to at least suggest that unless I can convince the court to overturn that decision, I'm in hot water here in terms of making this argument. So the other way that the court approaches this, and usually actually the starting place for their analysis, so let's make this 2 and make this 3, number 1 is precedent. And of course, sometimes the question is, well, is that precedent governed in this case? I mean, suppose a state decided to ban in vitro fertilization as a technique of reproduction. What would you do with that case?
Look at the precedent.
Okay, so let's start there. Well,
yeah.
What?
Yeah,
well.
I'm thinking.
Suppose you're trying to challenge the law. Is there any relevant precedent that you'd want to look at or you want to argue governs this case? I mean, there's not, those facts have not been litigated, but what's the closest we come?
Is that when you should look at the government regulating
the right
have a child.
You can look at abortion, because what's the similarity between the abortion context and the IVF context? I mean, they're different because one is about getting pregnant and the other is about ending a pregnancy, but what do they have in common? Well, no, but in a decisional sense, what's the category into which they both fall? Deciding to procreate or not. That's right. This is about decisional choice. And if you notice in Roe, the court says it's the right of the woman to decide whether or not to terminate a pregnancy. In Griswold, about contraceptives, whether or not to get pregnant. And so this is one end of the decisional choice. A woman wants to get pregnant. The state is interfering with her decision to choose to have a child. So you can argue Griswold, you can argue Roe, you can argue any of the procreation cases, and you can hope that the court says, yeah, you know what, this is really the same thing. And therefore, those precedents apply, and so we don't have to bother really with this or this. We know we're already going to be talking strict scrutiny, and the question is going to be, why is the state preventing this? And we're going to have to assess whether it's a compelling governmental interest or not. What if the court decides that, or might they decide that precedent is not close enough? Is there a distinction between the previous childbearing cases we've looked at, or cases involving decisions about whether to bear a child, and IVF? Some distinction that the court might want to draw? Or do these cases say that there's a right that attaches to every method of procreation? What if you wanted to procreate through human cloning? Would the court say, oh yes, you have a fundamental right to do that? Probably not. So what possible objection could there be to comparing childbirth in the Griswold Roe sense and childbirth in the IVF context? Any distinction the court might draw?
Well, yeah, I mean, they could try to suggest that there's, or I mean, the state could try to suggest that there's a fundamental difference with one is more of a natural than one, the other is your acting like God.
Okay, so one is the sort of the traditional means of getting pregnant, and the other is some technological innovation that may not be viewed in the same fashion as other means of procreation. So there's going to be an argument about whether the procreation cases do or do not apply. And this may be significant if states try and impose certain kind of restrictions on in vitro fertilization or other reproductive techniques, not ban them entirely, but some kind of restriction. The question is, well, what kind of standard is the court going to use?
When you make your argument, would you look at maybe the arguments or the dissents in the partial ban test? I mean, the partial ban case.
You're going to use whatever you can to try and convince a court that the precedents that it already exists govern, and each side is going to argue for different precedents, right? The woman is going to argue that Griswold and Roe, et cetera, Casey, govern this case and are relevant precedents. What's the government going to argue? Does it have cases that are going to suggest some kind of ability to distinguish those cases from the IVF context? What do you think? Can it argue that this is different? Can it argue that that those were cases rooted in history and tradition, and we don't have a tradition of reproduction through in vitro fertilization in the same way we do natural pregnancy without artificial intervention? Is there some way for the state to argue that there's a kind of a some line that gets drawn in these cases that might be relevant here? Because that'd be the question, right? The state's going to try and argue that these cases are distinguishable and do not govern, because they want to get back on this track, right? They want to be able to argue there's no history and tradition, and that we shouldn't go beyond one and two. All the conservative justices we've seen, they make one and two arguments. They don't want to touch three. Three is the kind of analysis that the more liberal justices are willing to recognize, an expansive view of fundamental rights. Okay, let's go back to Moore versus City of East Cleveland, sort of departure a little bit from this. Why does the court strike down the statute? It decides that Mrs. Moore has a fundamental right. What's wrong with this zoning ordinance, which is what this is? What's wrong with it?
It didn't actually reach the purpose.
What was the purpose?
To prevent overcrowding.
Overcrowding. In some cases, it doesn't reach it.
I guess the policy intended doesn't prevent what they were trying to, well, they said they were trying to prevent.
Right. Okay, it wouldn't necessarily prevent it because you could have a mother and a father who happen to have a dozen kids, right? And you could have lots of people in one household and they would fall within this definition. And what about Mrs. Moore? Does she present an overcrowding problem?
No.
Right, there are only three people in her household, and only two, one of them is old enough to drive. So if it's an overcrowding and too many cars on the street, and if you're worried about too many cars per household, what's a less restrictive alternative?
Limit the number of cars.
Limit the number of cars you can park in your driveway, et cetera, et cetera. So there are other, this is both what's normally called under-inclusive, because it doesn't get at all overcrowding problems because of the fact a single family could be large. It's also over-inclusive. It's also over-inclusive in addition to being under-inclusive, because it also prohibits certain small families from living together who don't present a risk of overcrowding. So because it has this phenomenon that it regulates some people who don't contribute to the problem and fails to regulate other people who do contribute to the problem, it's not a very close fit between ends and means. The court ultimately says that the state could accomplish its objectives by more carefully tailored techniques for dealing with the overcrowding crisis, even assuming that there is one. Although they're dubious that that's really the reason for the ordinance to begin with, so it struck down. Well, this case is in 1977, and it followed on the heels of an earlier case, Beltaire versus Boras, 1974, where the real facts were that the ordinance at issue, the zoning restriction, excluded unrelated groups from the village of Beltaire. And the unrelated groups principally were groups of students who were sharing a house that they rented. And it just so happens that the New York Times actually wrote a big piece about this issue just on Sunday, talking about the fact that there are all these houses and big developments where the owners can't afford to live in them anymore, and the rents are very cheap, and groups of students are now living in what they describe as McMansions. So they have rooms with private bathrooms and jacuzzis and swimming pools, and because you get a group of five or six students together and they rent a six-bedroom house, and they can easily afford the rent, and it's cheaper than dorm rooms. So this is a story about something going on in California, where there's a local university where this is apparently prevalent. So imagine that today, in the same circumstance, the town decides, hey, we don't like this. We don't like these groups of students with their loud parties living in our residential community. So we're going to essentially zone them out because they're unrelated groups. And they're gonna, the students are gonna complain, they're going to challenge the zoning restriction, and what are they gonna argue? What was their argument, unsuccessful as it was in the Belterre case? What would the students argue? They can't argue blood relationship, obviously. This isn't like the grandmother and her grandchildren. They can't argue married couple. Do they have any argument they can make?
They have basically have a right to live with whoever they want to live with that they feel is best for them.
That's what they're arguing, that this is the kind of personal choice about living arrangements that someone should be able to make for themselves free of governmental intrusion, that it involves deeply personal considerations as to the kind and quality of intimate relationships within the home, and that that's true whether or not there's a sexual relationship or not, that friends are, living with friends is also a kind of a level of intimacy. And the Supreme Court rejects this argument and says, you know what, there's a limit to our willingness to recognize intimate personal choices, and choosing roommates crosses the divide as far as we're concerned, and so they reject the claim. What if this was an argument about not unrelated groups, but what if we had a couple who were in a long-term intimate relationship, but they didn't believe in marriage? So they were living together in the town. The zoning ordinance required that people be related by blood or marriage. What do you think? Fundamental right? Any precedent that we can look at?
A common law. I mean, if they were together for a while.
I mean, Supreme Court precedent. Supreme Court precedent that goes beyond the traditional husband and wife unit.
Moore
recognizes that we've recognized relationships other than the traditional marital couple, and
right.
That we should the court should recognize that a broader tradition of people who live in an intimate relationship, whether it's sanctified by marriage or not. And of course, so they're going to try and argue Moore, they're going to try and argue history and tradition. That's not going to be such a strong argument for them, although if we can look at more recent tradition, maybe it works. But number three, of course, is a much more potent argument that this is an intimate personal choice, central to personal identity, and that someone should be able to make it free of state interference unless the state can satisfy strict scrutiny. Is the state going to be able to satisfy strict scrutiny? What if they say, we just don't believe in people living together outside of marriage? We think it's morally inappropriate. Is that going
to
work?
No, isn't that almost like a compulsion to marry them? They're telling them that then you must marry if you want to live together?
No, it's telling them either live apart or get, or it's telling them, have two separate households. You can visit each other frequently, but maintain two separate households or get married.
That's unreasonable, though, right?
That's the question, right? I mean, what's the state going to say? They're going to say, they're going to make the argument that this is a sort of traditional morality, that we want to encourage marriage. We don't want people to think it's a good idea to live together without being married. We think it sends the wrong message to children and teenagers about the choices that face them, that there's stability in marriage in a way that's not true of other relationships, et cetera, et cetera. And what's the court going to say? State too intrusive, you think? They're going to strike it down on what theory? Does the state have a compelling interest or not? Is the problem the state's interest, or is the problem the means?
They're taking it more as a moral stance.
It's a moral stance. Are morality-based justifications not compelling justifications? They're surely legitimate justifications,
no, they're not compelling.
So that means I think you'd have to make the argument that the state being able to visit its own definition of morality on people is not a compelling justification if this is, if there is a fundamental right. If it's not a fundamental right, then the state can do it, right? Because it's at least rational.
Is compelling typically health and safety?
No.
Okay.
Not only health and safety.
Okay.
Those are, you know, among the compelling reasons, but we can, you'd be able to identify more reasons than that. But there's a big argument about whether morality justifications could ever be viewed as compelling. Now, a lot of our law rests on morality justifications, but the question is that kind of justification sufficient to satisfy the compelling governmental interest, or does the state need something more than a morality-based justification? I mean, what if somebody challenges the state's law against incest? What's the state going to say their justification is? What?
Is that health and safety?
Ah, so there we don't just have a morality justification. We can say that it's the child's health and well-being that's at stake, not just a moral judgment that the state wants to make. So some of the time we can have justifications that cross that line and it go beyond morality, and there, of course, the state's going to be on the firmest ground when they can couple the morality justification with something beyond simply we don't think it's good, it's moral, or we think it's wrong and not right. I tell my students never to use the word pornography in my class, and that's because that's not a legal term. Not significant, it has no legal meaning at all. For purposes of the First Amendment, there are two categories that are relevant here. There is obscenity, which is a legally defined term and means a lot less than you think it means. I mean, in other words, it's a very narrow, restricted category of sexually explicit material. And then there is non-obscene sexually explicit material. If it's obscene, the government can prohibit it. If it's non-obscene, although sexually explicit, then the government's regulatory power is much lower because the speech at issue is protected by the First Amendment. So we can't talk about pornography because pornography includes both, and therefore it crosses a legal line, and therefore it's devoid of any meaning in terms of a legal analysis. It's a term we use when we're not being lawyers, but legally it's not a significant term. So the court, decides Beltaire and says no right for these unmarried people to live together.
I just have a question. When I was going to college, there was a really nice like condominium down the street. I went to University of Hartford, and they would not rent to University of Hartford students. But then I had a friend who had a single apartment, and they would rent single apartments, but you couldn't have roommates.
Right.
You couldn't get like a two-bedroom.
Right.
Like, they did not want us there.
But this was a privately owned building. This is a privately owned building. No. It has nothing to do with Beltaire versus Barras, because we're not talking about a decision made through a zoning ordinance, something the government did. Instead, a private developer doesn't want students in their building, and the only thing that could prohibit them from doing that is if the city had a zoning ordinance, had a law that protected students from housing discrimination based on their status, and I don't know of such laws.
No.
Anti-discrimination laws protect against a lot of discrimination, on various grounds. You can't discriminate against veterans, you can't discriminate, the list goes on and on, but I don't know that college students is a protected group under most statutes. So there's no constitutional question because it's private discrimination and not governmental discrimination.
Okay.
Whereas the zoning ordinance, is governmental discrimination, and therefore it can be challenged under the Constitution. Okay. So the last of the cases in this assignment is one of my favorites, which is this case involving Michael H. and Gerald D. on page 469. I think we've pretty much talked about all the rest of them in some fashion or other. This is a case involving a real kind of soap opera relationship, and the court, the book editor takes out all the juicy details about this. Well, let's talk about the case, and then I'll see if I have time for this. I know all about Carol D., the mother, and Michael H., and Gerald D. The bottom line is she's living with Michael. She leaves her husband. She's living with Michael H. Then she goes back to her husband. Then she goes and lives with Scott. Then she goes back to her husband. Then she goes back to Michael. So back, forth, back, forth, back, forth. But for a substantial period of time, she actually lived with Michael H. And her child, Victoria, and their child, Victoria. So it's not, the way it makes it seem is that he's some kind of stranger who comes along and says, oops, I just discovered I was this child's father. And it's not quite like that.
I thought maybe he was a donor.
No, no. I mean, he's a guy she had an affair with and lived with periodically when she left her husband, which was frequently. As California, what do you expect? And she, by the way, was an international model, and her husband was a top executive in a French oil company. They were traveling a lot, and anyway. So what's being challenged here is a provision of California evidence law, the evidence code, that says the issue of a child, of a wife, so basically she returns to her husband and Michael, and they say, and now Gerald is going to act like the child's father, and Michael H., we want you out of our lives. He goes to court to try and essentially retain a relationship with his child and establish his rights to visitation with his child. They protest that that legally he is not the child's father, he says, but I have proof, right? Because we have a blood test, and the blood test proves 98.07% probability that I am the child's father, and similarly, blood tests would prove that Gerald is not the child's biological father. And they argue that that he can't introduce that evidence, that's not introducible in this proceeding, because California evidence code provides as follows. The issue of a wife cohabitating with her husband, so a woman cohabitating with her husband who has a child, and where the husband is not impotent or sterile, so he's capable of having children, is conclusively presumed to be a child of the marriage. It's a conclusive presumption of paternity by the husband.
They really turned the other way.
Boy, they're
just kind of like COVID show.
All I'm thinking of is
we're not looking at the father.
Right. So Michael H. goes to court and challenges the constitutionality of this provision, a provision which prevents him from establishing a biological fatherhood as against the child Victoria. And the case goes to the United States Supreme Court, and he argues what? What would his argument be? He has a fundamental right to be a father, to have a relationship with his
child.
With his biological child, right? He has the status of a biological father, and he asserts that relationship, that his right to continue a relationship, is one of those intimate personal choices central to personal identity, the father-child relationship.
It would be history and tradition too.
And he would try and argue that relationship is long protected. Although, as it turns out, Justice Scalia does not see it that way. What's his problem with the Michael H. being considered to fall within the tradition of parent-child relationships, or protecting those relationships? Does he consider a Michael H. to be just any old biological father?
Well,
or does he want to describe him in a somewhat more specific way? How does, what's the game changer for Justice Scalia?
The adulterously
conceived. He's an adulterous biological father. That's right. He's not any old biological father. He's an adulterous biological father, and he is seeking to intervene in a nuclear family, father, mother, child. And so Justice Scalia says, "What about the situation of an adulterous biological father?" Is there a tradition?
Not the one that includes him.
Not one that includes him. Justice Scalia says, when I look at tradition, I look at tradition in the most specific way possible. Not how we treat biological fathers, but how we treat adulterous biological fathers. And he does not find any tradition of protecting people in the position of Michael H., which is what he concludes here, that central to him was the historic respect, indeed sanctity would not be too strong a term, traditionally accorded to the relationships that develop within the unitary family. And it's impossible, in fact, quite to the contrary, our traditions have protected the marital family against the sort of claim Michael asserts. Notice that sort of claim. I mean, he's obviously quite dismissive of this guy, and he doesn't find him to fall within tradition. By contrast, Justice O'Connor disagrees with that, and Justice Brennan writes a dissent. And what kind of tradition does he want to call up? How would he describe Michael H.? Well, would he call him an adulterous biological father? He wants to use a broader tradition. Well, what's the broader tradition into which Michael H. could fit? Why, he want to call himself, I mean, would that help Michael H. if we label him a father of an illegitimate child? What do we want to describe him as?
Father of the child.
He's a biological father. That's right.
And to protect the interest of the child, not to have an illegitimate child. So that would be.
Well, I mean, it's.
Because there is really, for him, it's not an illegitimate child. And if you want to protect the rights of the child, then he would go with the real father.
So, I mean, but Brennan says, look, our tradition is a tradition of protecting the rights of biological fathers. And that's our general tradition, and that's the tradition we should consult, and not some specific tradition about adulterous biological fathers. So he gets to make use of all the cases in which biological fathers have been able to assert the right to an ongoing relationship with their child. And why does he do this? Why is the general, he says in part, look, science has meant that we can determine for sure who the father is. At the time that this presumption was crafted, it was impossible to know. And so Michael H. was just could have been an interloper, a stranger who just asserts paternity. We'd have no way of proving to the contrary. Now we know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that he is actually the father. So Justice Brennan says the traditional view that the rights of the marital father trump the rights of the biological father no longer make any sense given modern science. And so what's his theory about why our views about tradition can change, or our views about relationships can change over time?
Well, one of his examples is that the stigma of illegitimacy is no longer.
Okay.
So,
but again, that's the same thing. I mean, things have changed argument. Why does it matter? Justice Scalia doesn't care if things have changed, right? He wants the Constitution to mean what it meant before. What does Justice Brennan want us to be able to do?
He wants the Constitution to be able to change.
He wants
to adapt to society as we change.
That's right. He says the document that the plurality construes today is unfamiliar to me. It is not the living charter that I have taken to be our constitution. It is instead a stagnant, archaic, hidebound document steeped in the prejudices and superstitions of a time long past. He says, my view is the constitution is a living document and that our rights can change and develop as circumstances change over time, and we're not fixed, written in stone at the time of the adoption of the Constitution. And so for him, if you consult the broader tradition of biological fathers, then Michael H. falls within that tradition. And I presumably, even if he, you know, maybe he, if he's not a biological father, but he has some ongoing relationship, he might just say consult the tradition of fathers in general, biological or otherwise. He's looking for the broadest tradition to take account of changing circumstances and not the narrow tradition that Justice Scalia consults. Okay, so the two remaining cases both have to do with state statutes about sodomy, and one overturns the other. So the court decides Bowers in 1986, a challenge to a Georgia law that defines sodomy as committing or submitting to any sexual act involving the sex organs of one person and the mouth or anus of another. So it's a ban on all sodomy, heterosexual, homosexual, all sodomy. And it's challenged in a case involving the police went to a home for other unrelated reasons. They discovered a homosexual couple. They didn't prosecute, but because the police intruded and threatened prosecution, there was standing on the part of Hardwick to challenge the Georgia sodomy statute and argue that it could be applied to him in the future. And he argued it violated his fundamental right to privacy to have the state try and control his sexual behavior in this way. And the court rejects that claim. So what are the reasons that the court rejects that claim? Justice White writes the opinion. What does he say?
Well, there was a long history of tradition. Well, this is rejecting that as a fundamental right, that it criminalizing such behavior, society looked down upon such behavior.
Okay. No history and tradition, so no fundamental right. What else?
Not protected as a family issue by the Constitution.
Okay, but not protected as a family issue because?
Because it has nothing to do with marriage appropriation.
Okay, and why, I mean, what's that in the service of this, what kind of argument is he making when he says that this is different? An argument, what's he examining and then decides, oh, this is different?
He's looking to see if it's a fundamental right.
But what's he looking at specifically in making that argument? Is that, is he talking about number three? Does he want to talk about that? What does he say about arguments that go beyond history and tradition? What does he say about number three arguments?
There was no connection between family and marriage and procreation, which had been established in earlier cases.
Cases! Precedent! That's what he says. He says exactly this. He says he found the right was not fundamental within the meaning of the court's precedents under the Due Process Clause. And he distinguishes all of these other cases and say the rights announced in those cases don't bear any resemblance to the claimed constitutional right of homosexuals to engage in acts of sodomy. So he looks at precedent, he looks at history and tradition, and does he go past that or does he stop? He stops, because what's he worried about? If he, what's his complaint about number three? Too expansive, right? So he says only number one and two, and they don't help, and so Hardwick loses. By contrast, of course, Justice Blackmun writes a dissent, and what does he have to say about why he would reach a different conclusion?
Well, he says that one of the fundamental rights is to be left alone.
Okay, but more than, I mean, we don't, that's a kind of an exaggeration. We don't have the right to be left alone, right? I mean, if you want to murder people in your house, you can't say, I have a right to be left alone. The state has no right to investigate what I'm doing here, right?
But he
He thinks that they narrow the question to, he writes that the right to question has been defined too narrowly. No, that's not where he wants to go.
Well, okay, and if he broadens it out, why does he broaden it out? That's right. He says what's a key for him is sexual intimacy is a sensitive key relationship of human existence. The fact that individuals define themselves in a significant way through their intimate sexual relationship with others suggests, et cetera, et cetera. What's that?
That's number three.
That's number three. Sure. The dissent says, I do number three. I find this to be a fundamental right. The majority says only one and two count. I don't like this expansive, elastic definition of fundamental rights. I'm not going there. And the court decides Bowers. In 2003, the court changes its mind and says Bowers was wrong. It used the wrong analysis, and we'll pick up with Lawrence on Thursday. And I think that's not a problem because we have a relatively short assignment for Thursday's reading. We're going to start equal protection, but we'll first complete discussing Lawrence, and then we'll move on to the equal protection cases. I would have kept you longer, except I learned only before coming to class that criminal law is meeting tonight. I can't keep up with
not
this,
next week.
But not this week.
Well, not the 29th.
Not the 29th, right. I think if we do okay on Thursday, then we won't need to.
Not yesterday, but last Thursday,
mm-hmm.
I was late, so I think I missed the sign-up sheet.
Yep. Okay, I'm going to just shut